It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
What up? Hey, welcome back. It's good to have you here on Money for Lunch. It's we're wrapping up the month of August. It's amazing how quickly time is flying by. Just a few more months. I think something like 60 days left. Is it right? 65 days, and then Halloween is upon us. Holidays, Halloween, and then of course, you know, that starts the big, you know, all the big holiday seasons, right? You have Halloween, Thanksgiving, you have Christmas, and I think we also have several Jewish holidays, Passover, the Celebration of Lights. Anyway, so a lot of stuff happening already, or about to happen, I guess. Anyway, I'm reeling from just a fantastical weekend, and I hope your weekend was nice as mine. What did we do? Well, we went to the Arizona Grand Spa Resort, and we hung out, and we laid around and did nothing but sleep and eat and sleep some more. So, you know, it was all accounts just a crazy, crazy, wild weekend, but thoroughly enjoyable and fully rested. All right, let's get this party started. My first guest today is one of my favorite people, simply because he's passionate about helping individuals fight for their disability. Francis Jackson is one of our regular contributors, and he's an attorney who specializes in disability law for those seeking veterans disability benefits and Social Security disability benefits. A founding partner at Jackson McNichol, he is featured on CBS, NBC, Fox, ABC network affiliates around the country. Most recently appeared as a guest of the Ben Glass on the Consumer Advocate Show, discussing benefits for veterans and Social Security disability benefits and how his practice allows him to make a difference in the lives of the people facing disability. He's also been quoted in USA Today and is a best-selling author with a Quillie Award in September of 2012 for his contribution as a joint author to the Amazon best-selling book Protect and Defend, where he wrote about protecting one's rights to veterans' disability compensation. Francis Jackson, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thanks so much, Bert. It's always a pleasure to be able to talk with you.
You bet, man. And we appreciate what you guys do there at Jackson McNichol. Hey, and so I want to kind of ask you this, because over time, you and I have talked quite a bit about the problems that the VA has had. I just kind of want to get your opinion on this. What do you think? What does the American public think the VA is doing or how they're doing?
Interesting you should ask that, Bert. There was a recent public poll, and essentially about less than one quarter of the folks polled thought that the government was doing enough to help veterans. About 26% said they were very clear that the government was not doing enough. And the other 50% said they really didn't have much of a view on the issue. So I think the short version is that the negative press that the VA has gotten has left them with a less than stellar reputation.
Yeah. And you know what? And it's a very large agency. Secretary McDonald's is trying to get a handle on it. I think that, unfortunately, it's one of those things where, just when you think that they've gotten somewhat of a handle on it, then something else breaks loose. I mean, you find out about, you know, the fact that these records were misplaced or ignored or this other problems having. So yeah, the press continues to leak out, or I should say the negative press continues to, you know, follow them.
I think that's for sure. And unfortunately, you know, as you pointed out, there have been some leadership changes. And, you know, that sort of thing never contributes to stability. It's just a real problem agency at this point. It's large and not well managed. And even though it has a big budget, it's actually not well funded for what it's expected to do. And all those problems just kind of come together, and the results have not been pretty.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about this. I want to talk about the women veterans. How is the VA doing with our women veterans?
Well, that's a real mixed bag. Keep in mind that when the agency was formed, there were no women veterans, period. And so adjusting to the notion that they need to provide services to women has taken some time and become really a difficult transition in many ways for the VA. There are now over 2 million women veterans out of the roughly 22 million veterans in the U.S. And, you know, if you just look at the comparison here, the number enrolled with VA's health system, for example, has doubled since 9/11. There are over 600,000 women enrolled now. There were less than 300,000 enrolled before 9/11. And it's been hard for the VA to adjust for their services. You know, they are still working on figuring out where to put services and how to deliver services for things like prenatal care, obstetrics, mammograms, other specifically feminine needs. But the interesting part, I think, is the biggest area where women veterans are complaining that they're not being served is in the area of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Wow.
Lots of female veterans, as you know, serve in support roles, and many of them were in either, Iraq or Afghanistan in those roles. And one area that the military doesn't talk about very much is there's also been a very high incidence of military sexual trauma related toward women, some toward men as well, but women in particular. And so there's there are a number of generators, if you will, for PTSD-type problems. And women have been uncomfortable, to put it mildly, participating in group therapy with men after they've been sexually traumatized, that sort of thing. So it's really a challenge for the VA to try to put together a comprehensive program for women veterans across the nation. I mean, it's easy enough for them to build a particular program in a particular place, but trying to distribute those services somewhat proportionally to the population of women's veterans across the entire 50 states has proven to be a huge challenge for them, and they're still working at it. I mean, you have to give them credit; they're trying, but it's uphill at this point.
Sure. You know, what's interesting to me is the fact that this was not a thought. As you said, when the VA was first formed, this was not a thought at all. That women veterans was not a thought, and that seems odd to me. And I guess I'm saying that, of course, 2020 is hindsight, but
you know, women were working in the military in a lot of administrative roles for a very long time, and then you had what do you call it, women who took on other roles too besides administrative, you know. So it just seems odd to me that women didn't enter into the VA's matrix at all. It just seems like, I guess this is what happens when you have a bunch of guys who put something together.
Well, you have to, in fairness to them, think about it. The VA goes back really to the post World War I era, and really there weren't significant numbers of women in the military until World War II, when we really were desperate for person power instead of man power, if you will, and created the WACs and the WAVES and the WAFs and so on. So in fairness to the VA, I mean, they had no reason to see it coming from the beginning, but you would think that from World War II forward, they might have been a little more forward-thinking than they have been.
Well, see, and I just learned something new, because for whatever reason, I thought that the VA didn't get started until around World War II. But you're right. You know, the women in military service didn't really become strong until World War II, and that's why I was kind of chastising them a little bit. But okay, so let's talk about this. You know, a while back we heard that there were some health problems stemming from contaminated drinking water at the big Marine base in Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. What's happening there? What's going on?
Well, the VA has been authorized now to provide health care for folks who may have contracted diseases from that exposure. But probably the big thing that's happened, and this is very recent, the VA just announced that they were going to do this, and they're still really working on formulating exactly how they're going to do it. But they have now concluded that they're going to offer what's called presumptive service connection, meaning that if you have this disease, they're going to assume that it's service-connected, and they're going to treat you as though it was service-connected, both for purposes of medical care and for purposes of financial compensation. And that's for three conditions so far. They've identified kidney cancer.
Wow.
They've identified sarcoma of the liver, and they have identified myelogenous leukemia as all potentially related to the exposure at Camp Lejeune, which is primarily for benzene, vinyl chloride, and I can never even pronounce these right, trichloroethylene, that's all of which are known to be carcinogenic. So,
right.
The VA is at least trying to step up here, and you know, it's always good to give them a pat on the back when they try and do the right thing, and they are trying to do the right thing here. So, we'll see what happens. But it's apparently this was a serious problem that went undetected for a long time. The sampling indicates apparently that the problem goes back to at least 1953.
Oh my goodness!
Went on at least into the late 80s, probably later than that, although they haven't been definitive beyond that. So it's it exposed, you know, huge numbers of people, because Lejeune is a transfer base, so lots of folks pass through there. But, you know, as I said, the VA is trying to do the right thing here, and more power to them.
Absolutely. Like you said, it's always good to give them a pat on the back. That's just amazing that it goes back that far. It's just crazy. Let's talk about this. Have there been any other recent developments in service-connected disability benefits for veterans?
Well, there have been a couple. One good, one bad, if you will.
Okay.
Actually, maybe both bad, depending on your point of view. But let me explain. One that is not good is that the VA so far is not treating sailors who were exposed to Agent Orange as qualifying for the presumption that Agent Orange-related diseases like diabetes are service-connected. And the way it works is folks who were stationed in Vietnam, who were, the VA likes to use the phrase, boots on the ground, in Vietnam, are presumed to be service-connected for those diseases commonly associated with Agent Orange, and those include diabetes is probably the most common. There are a bunch of cancers, including leukemia and sarcoid and prostate cancer and several others. And if you were either on the ground there or if you were assigned to Coast Guard or Navy units in what they call brown water, meaning you were on the rivers in Vietnam, then you're assumed or presumed to have been exposed to Agent Orange, and you're entitled to both the health care and the compensation for these problems. But so far, unlike the Australians, the U.S. has not extended that presumption of exposure to all the Navy folks who were in the South China Sea. And so it's a real problem for them. Some of those folks have been determined on an individual basis to have been exposed to Agent Orange and have gotten the presumption for both service connection and for the potential compensation for those diseases. But lots of folks still haven't. Right now, there are still bills pending in the House and Senate to extend the Agent Orange Act of 91 to sailors who served in the waters off Vietnam. But as I said, those are bills pending. That's not a reality. So it's really kind of a tough thing for a lot of those folks. A lot of them have really had a very tough time with those diseases and have not gotten the compensation that they would otherwise have been entitled to, or the medical care that they would have otherwise been entitled to.
Okay, so let me ask you this. This is a perfect example. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit and ask you, okay, so in a case like this, where you have these sailors that are being denied, this is, first of all, a perfect example when a veteran needs an attorney, but how would your office help sailors or somebody who's been denied a claim like this in order to get them, service-connected disabilities?
Well, what you have to do in those cases, and you can do it in a lot of cases, but not all, I want to just say up front, what you have to do is you have to demonstrate the extent to which those folks were potentially exposed to Agent Orange. And there are lots of pieces to that. Depending on the ship, sometimes there's helicopter or airplane traffic in and out. Sometimes these ships are docked for periods of time delivering supplies. Sometimes there are transfers of personnel. And so it's a question, really, in each case of trying to put together all the facts that explain why this particular person on this particular ship was likely to have been exposed to Agent Orange and how that matches up to their current disabilities. As I mentioned, some disabilities that stem from Agent Orange are so common in their association with Agent Orange that the VA recognizes what's called a presumption. So
right.
They know that with diabetes, for example, or prostate cancer or kidney cancer, that those conditions are frequently caused by Agent Orange. And so if you can show factually how this particular sailor was likely exposed to Agent Orange, whether it's because they were anchored close in offshore and exposed to the prevailing winds, or this person was in supply and was on the launch that went back and forth a lot, or this person handled aircraft coming in from various bases on land. You know, there are a number of different ways that you can do it, but it depends, of course, on the factual situation for each person. And quite honestly, sometimes you just can't make a good enough case. But we've had pretty good success with several folks, and I know there are other firms that have as well, in persuading individual judges at the Board of Veterans Appeals that the facts of this case were so compelling that even though the presumption doesn't apply, they should find as a factual matter that this person was exposed. And, you know, sometimes it works. Sadly, it doesn't always.
Gotcha. But to me, this is a great example why if you're a veteran, your claim has been denied, you need some help, this is a perfect example why an attorney can sometimes make the difference between you getting your claims and not getting your claims, right? This is a perfect example that you need sometimes somebody to come in and give and look at your case, give you that 30,000 foot view and say, okay, this is what here are the missing links that we need to prove up in order to make your claim.
That's right. And sadly, the other situation that I was going to tell you about sort of highlights the same problem. The VA's internal inspection system, the Inspector General for the VA, got notified in January of this year that the VA in Los Angeles was shredding documents relating to people's compensation claims. And so they sent a surprise inspection team in, and of course they couldn't retrieve the stuff that had already been shredded, but what they did was to review the documents in the immediate bins waiting to be shredded. And what they found was that there were numerous documents associated with people's claims, potentially dispositive of people's claims, that were in the shredding bins.
Wow.
And
wow.
That's scary.
It is scary.
And so one of the ways
here's the thing that is so troubling. You know, there is no reason to shred these claims. It's not, you know, it's not money coming out of these people's pockets. This, you know, they benefit nothing by shredding these claims other than hurting people's lives. And it's really frustrating. And Francis, unfortunately, we're out of time, but it's always good to have you on the show. And we appreciate the work that you do of taking care of our veterans there at Jackson McNichol Law Firm. Thank you so much for stopping by today.
Always a pleasure, Bert. You take care.
All righty. Guys, great stuff there from Francis Jackson. And you know, again, just about all of us know somebody who served. If you know a veteran, if he or she has been denied claims, have them check out our good friends at jackson-mcnichol.com. Jackson-mcnichol.com. Do not suffer in silence. You've earned your disability. You've earned some help. Call Francis and his team. They'll talk to you for free. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on Geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. Laura Rubenstein is my next guest. Laura Rubenstein is an award-winning social media and marketing strategist, certified hypnotherapist, and best-selling author of the book, Social Media Myths Busted, The Small
Business Guide to Online Revenue. She's the president and co-founder of Social Buzz Club and creator of the Savvy Social Media Success Course. With more than 22 years of marketing experience and focus on relationship building, Laura has optimized marketing plans and developed branding strategies for more than 1,000 businesses globally. Her profit-generating results and popular blog at transformtoday.com make her a highly sought-after speaker, consultant, and mentor to thousands of business owners everywhere. Laura Rubenstein, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Oh, thanks for having me, Bert. Glad to be here.
You bet, you bet. All right, let's talk about that. I want to talk about social media myths. A lot of people are, are talking about, social media is like this great lead generator, this great way to make money. And at the same time, I think that social media is kind of overhyped up. What is your take?
Well, I think that social media is, on the one hand, overhyped, but on the other hand, has a lot of resistance.
Right.
The people who are going to be using it, a lot of them, say things like, it's too noisy, I don't have time for that. There's all kinds of what I call excuses for not using social media. So I tend to focus on where are people resisting and is this valid or not?
Gotcha. All right, so let's talk about this resistance. So if you have a business owner or one of our listeners who, let's say, they're resistant to social media, what's the first steps to overcoming that?
The biggest reason people have resistance is because they bought into a myth about social media, kind of like what I was just talking about. And people are really afraid of just a few things. They're either afraid of a lack of privacy, being forced, quote unquote, to read things that they don't care about, what somebody had for lunch or an angry, grumpy kitty thing, or wasting time. Some people are technologically phobic, and I actually have solutions for each of those. So just real quick, if you want, I'll go into them.
Yeah, let's go into them.
All right. So there are the myths about privacy. Like a lot of people feel like they're going to be vulnerable if they get onto Facebook. And that actually perplexes me a little bit, because if they're concerned about other people seeing family member photos, you actually can control what you post. Number one. Number two, post only what you're comfortable with the whole world seeing, right? If you want to keep something private, just simply keep it off of social media, period.
Right.
End of story, privacy taken care of. just imagine this is a public publishing platform, and if you don't want anything to be public, well then, guess what, it's not for you. But if you don't mind, a few things, I don't personally use it as some way to expose my whole personal life. It just doesn't make any sense to me to do it. But there are some things you wouldn't mind, a pretty scenery, around your house or on a vacation. And by the way, do the vacation photos after you get back from vacation, so you're not letting people know you're on vacation. It's like, here was my vacation. Isn't it great or wasn't it great? The second thing is, the whole concept of being forced to read things you don't care about. So I want to give everyone listening today, anyone listening in the future, permission to avoid the homepage on the social networks, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, you have my permission to not go there. They are rabbit holes. Stay away from the homepage. Create a friend list or of the people you want to see. You could create a Twitter list of the people you want to see their stuff, not everybody or what Facebook thinks you should read. You can certainly control it, and now even Facebook has something called See First. If you go to somebody's profile, you hover over the following button. There's a default or a See First. If there's someone you definitely want to see, click the See First. And then it will show up in the homepage. And set an egg timer when you're going to go to a homepage so that you don't waste that time. Because, I talk to clients, people using social media for business, about setting aside 15 minutes a day, and that's it for social media. to do things, to engage, to do things like checking comments and mentions and messages, to reply to any of those comments or messages, and to post their own content or comments. 15 minutes a day, and you're good to go.
Wow. All right. So let me stop you there and ask you this, because it seems like 15 minutes a day is just such a small amount of time. So let's talk about this. What is the real value for businesses to be on social media at all? I mean, it seems like 15 minutes a day is such a small amount. So kind of give me your tips or your thoughts on why, you know, the real value for businesses on social media.
This is a really good question. The value for business is, if you have a business, would you like people talking about you to their friends, family members, contacts, colleagues, connections? It's kind of the most powerful form of marketing there is, word of mouth. Social media put that on steroids for us. So if you as a business want to take advantage of that and get that word of mouth buzz going, that's the biggest value, because what does that do? If you want more traffic to your websites and you have people talking about you and your business, the first place online they want to go is to a website. It also gives you the opportunity to build relationships with existing customers. It's a place your customers can find you in a public forum where they can either find out your latest, you know, events, schedules, specials, whatever it is that you offer, and stay in touch and feel like they are connected to you. There are opportunities you can gain by connecting with other industry leaders. You could do joint ventures. You can get speaking engagements. You can get clients. You can also do a ton of market research, find out about what others are doing online, industry trends, how to stay up with it. So there's just so many benefits for businesses today that I think they far outweigh any of the drawbacks.
Well, and one of the things that I think for a lot of people who just, you know, they probably just had an aha moment where you're saying, hey, spend 15 minutes, you know, spend 15 mm-hmm. minutes a day and that's mm-hmm. it. And I think for a lot of people, they just probably are breathing a sigh of relief, because, you know, I know that there's some people who supposedly spend 3 or 4 hours a day on social media, and this is where they generate all their traffic and they generate all their leads. And I certainly don't believe them. I think that, yes, you can generate some traffic. Yes, you can generate some buzz. But I don't think it's, in my opinion, and I'd like to get your opinion on this. It seems like if you're going to spend 3 or 4 hours a day on social media, there are other avenues to, you know, for lead generation for those 3 or 4 hours. I mean, you could do cold calling and generate probably better leads. You can go to, places like LinkedIn or networking meetings to generate, I think, better leads. What's your take?
Depends what you're doing in those 3 or 4 hours. So if, you know, there are people who will use LinkedIn, for example, and connect with people and you know, do a lot of that one-on-one interaction.
Right.
We'll get a lot of business from it. It depends. You know, I always say don't start on social media without a plan and really evaluating who your market is, what they're doing there, and what they value. Because if you're reaching out to them in the wrong way, you're right, it's a complete waste of time. You might as well do cold calling. However, you know, cold calling can take, you know, 3 to 4 hours to get one client. So, you know, it just depends what you're doing online and if you have the proper strategy. It doesn't have to take 3 to 4 hours to when you do have a proper strategy.
Right.
So you can use advertising to do a lot of the work for you.
Oh, I like that.
Time or money,
that.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about this real quick. What do you see? What are the biggest mistakes businesses make when they start using social media?
They don't really start with a blueprint, like I was saying, a strategy to where that starts with knowing your audience, developing your brand identity for the social media platforms such that it's consistent with your offline identity and your personal websites or your business websites. So once you've got the audience established, the brand identity identity status. Now, what do you want to do? What's your objective on social media? You got to put your purpose out there for yourself and then set the goals that align with that purpose. One thing I will warn businesses, if your sole purpose is to make sales, it's like walking into a live networking meeting, shaking someone's hand and saying, hi, would you like to buy my product, service, book, training program, whatever, and instantly you've turned them off. So that is not the initial goal. So once you set appropriate goals for social media, you want to choose the right networks to do that on. Then you want to get set up right on those networks and optimize them, kind of like getting a nice website set up. You also want to do that for your social network accounts. And then you choose the right strategies. And when I talk about developing a blueprint or a strategy, I actually talk about three different types of strategies. A content strategy, which is where people usually stop. But that's where I start, okay? Then there's an engagement plan. How do you actually converse and communicate and connect with these people online? And then there's a tribe building. You know, how do you build this community online? So you put those three together that in order to match your objectives and goals, and then you create an implementation plan. Who's going to do what when?
All right, so we have content plan, an engagement plan, and a tribe building plan. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I like that. And you know what? The other thing that I wanted to ask you was, when I think of social media, I really think of a place like Facebook or Twitter. Primarily, I think of Facebook as a social media. Twitter is my second social media place.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about LinkedIn. To me, LinkedIn is more like that networking meeting. And mm-hmm. and again, just like you said about networking, if you show up to a networking meeting and the first words out of your mouth is, you know, hi, my name is Bert, buy my stuff, you're going to kill people. They're going to run away from you. But it seems like LinkedIn is more of a business-oriented type of environment where people know that you are there to do business as well as build a relationship, where Facebook is really kind of that party setting, right, that you're there to entertain and engage and have fun, and business is kind of like the second or third reason you're on Facebook. Am I looking at it correctly or not?
Yeah, I look at it almost like that. With regard to the party aspect, I feel like for the individuals, they're there. For the businesses interacting with individuals, yes, they have to entertain them or offer them. It's really good for businesses that offer something for consumers, or they're inspirational, they're thought leaders. You know, the high-tech industry really isn't on Facebook per se. They're more on LinkedIn type of thing. They're also
right.
on Google Plus, which we haven't mentioned. So, but yeah, each network has its own kind of culture, like you're alluding to. And, you know, you have to find out what your market is doing there, if they're there at all.
Yes. Okay, so let's talk real quick, just a real quick, snippet here on about Google Plus. I have not been a big active individual on Google Plus simply because Google has this habit of starting something, and they've had a social media attempt before. They didn't like it and they killed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very fearful they're going to do the same thing with Google Plus, that they're going to get tired of it, and they're just. They're going to kill it. So what's your take on Google Plus? Are you a big fan?
I'm a fan of it, and I don't look at it like any other network out there. I look at it as a really great way to position yourself on Google, because Google Plus is a layer on top of everything else Google. It's really not it's like people call it a social network, but Google calls it a social layer. So it ties in with the Google Calendar, it ties in with Gmail, it ties in with YouTube, it ties in with all kinds of Google platforms, right? So is it going anywhere? Who knows? Right now, it's here to stay for now. They also just did the Google Photos thing, which they kind of separated out from Google Plus, but that's okay. It's all, and then they have Google Hangouts on Air, which is tied into Google Plus. So I'm of the mindset Google Plus isn't going anywhere, but that still wouldn't, even if you told me it was going away in a year and a half, I'd still be on there now. Because they index everything. Google indexes into their search. So yes. If you have, you know, new radio shows coming out and you want to put links to them and you want Google to find them more easily, why not post them to the Google Plus page?
Yeah, I like your attitude. I mean, it doesn't hurt to do it now. It doesn't matter whether they're gone a month from now or a year from now or whatever. It doesn't hurt. It's a Google product, and Google's always going to give their products kind of a special thumbs up kind of a deal, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. All right, Laura, we're out of time. I would love to bring you back and talk more about social media and marketing strategy. Laura Rubenstein, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Bert.
You bet. All right, guys, we're off and running. Great stuff there about the big do's and don'ts when it comes to social media. You have to have a strategy content a strategy for engagement, and a strategy for building your tribe, your following. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
My name is Peter Shank, and I have a new book coming out called Zombie Loyalists, Using Great Service to Create Rabid Fans. If you go to a restaurant and you eat there and they really like you and you go back a lot and they treat you really well and they buy you a free drink and you bring friends and all you want to do is go to that place and that's the restaurant you go to all the time, you're a zombie loyalist for that restaurant. In my new book, I'm going to show you how to create zombie loyalists for your business, whatever kind of business that is. You're going to create customers who are so in love with you. They want to do your PR, they want to do your marketing, and they want to do your advertising for you. Remember, when you tell the world how awesome you are, no one believes you. But when someone else tells the world how awesome you are, everyone believes it. I'm going to show you how to be awesome to those customers so they bring you more and more customers and driving your revenue through the roof. Sales are going to explode. Customers are going to explode. Everyone is going to love you. This book will change what you think about your customers, how you treat them, and how you do business. It's going to be a wild ride. Everyone loves zombies. Buckle up.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right. We are back. My next guest, Dr. Michael Roizen. Dr. Michael Roizen is a New York Times best-selling author and co-founder and originator of the popular realage.com website. He's a chief wellness officer and chair of the Wellness Institute of Cleveland Clinic and the chief medical consultant to the Dr. Oz Show. He's been here before. It's always good to have him on the show, Dr. Michael Roizen. Welcome back to Money for Lunch.
It's a privilege to be here, Bert. Thank you.
You bet. All right, so let's talk about this. You know, there is so much overwhelm about aging, and I wanted to maybe touch on some of the biggest myths about aging.
Well, there's three major myths about aging. The first is that your genes tell you where they want you to go. That is that aging is all in the genes. It isn't. What we know from the ENCODE project, which is probably the most important scientific project since the genome project, the ENCODE project was an attempt to find out what the DNA you have in your cell is that isn't your genes. What we found out with the DNA project, if you will, or the genome project, was you had 22 to 30,000 genes, but that only accounted for roughly 10% of your DNA. The rest of the DNA, it turns out, is switches that turn on or off your genes. Your genes just make proteins. They're protein factories. It's like the most efficient protein factories in the world. They cost virtually nothing, and you have them, and they will turn on and make proteins, and you control the switches. That's the amazing thing. So, for example, if you have, we have around 550 genes that cause that produce inflammatory proteins that cause inflammation when you are stressed. So stress, an event such as stress, causes you to produce proteins that give you extra energy in fight or flight, which was very useful in the days when stress was the woolly mammoth attacking you. It let you get away from it or let you kill the bacteria, if it was an inflammatory bacteria, and survive. But those responses are dysfunctional now. So learning how to manage stress, you get to turn off the 550 proteins. And one of the studies last year, in fact, three of them, showed that learning how to manage stress with whether it is diaphragmatic breathing or guided imagery or meditation helps you prevents you from turning on those 550 genes and keeping those 500 inflammatory proteins away from your body so they don't rot your brain.
That's amazing. Okay, so wait, I want to back up because one of the things that you said is that we have these genes, and these genes are nothing more than these, protein manufacturers, and that we have some control over these genes or all of these genes?
We don't know that you have control over all of them yet, and we don't know how to control all of them yet. But we know how to control a huge number of them. So
gotcha.
Of the... If you will, of the roughly 22,000 genes that were well characterized, we now know something around 10,000 things that you can do that control about 10,000 of those.
Wow, so about half.
Well, and we think it may be more than that. We just don't know for sure yet.
Gotcha. All right. Let me ask you this. I want to get your take on this. Is aging a natural part of life?
So aging is a normal and natural part of life from a sense that all of us will do it, but the rate of aging is very different. So let me give you a specific. So every 10 years older, you have three times more defects in your cells. So if you're 30 years older, you have roughly 27 times, 3 times 3 times 3, more defects. Or, if you will, from an energy standpoint, you feel about a lot older. You don't feel the energy. Well, just think if you could keep yourself 30 years younger, and that's what's possible. In fact, so that the rate of aging, in other words, at age 75, you can actually feel like you're 45 with current knowledge, nothing new. But we're likely to get a huge breakthrough in the next 10 to 15 years. That's the prediction of, you were talking about Google just before. Well, that's the prediction of the chief Google scientist involved in this. He's the chief Google innovation officer, Ray Kurzweil. And he knows there are 14 areas, he and I have talked about this, there are 14 areas of hot research in aging. And he thinks that based on the amount of money being put in and the amount of effort, that it's likely we will have a breakthrough so that within 15 years you'll be able to live to 160 with the quality of your life you're living then. That is, we'll be able to slow aging dramatically, much more dramatically than we can now. He's the same guy who predicted to the day when Big Blue Computer, the IBM computer, beat the Kasparov, the chess champion at the time. He's the same guy who did a lot on Moore's Law and has done the solar prediction. So he's got a very solid track record of being able to predict things. And he thinks it's more likely than not, much more likely than not, that we'll have a major breakthrough in the next, I guess it would be 14 years.
Wow! You know what? And it's amazing. We're constantly finding out more and more and more about our bodies and the way our bodies and our minds in our mind work and how we can optimize our bodies and optimize our minds. It's, you know, here we are looking at aging today a lot differently than we thought about aging, you know, 20 years ago. It's now very common to have somebody live to, you know, 80 or 90 or 100 years old.
That's right. In other words, we have increased the average, the life expectancy at birth from 47 in 1900 to 77 in 2000. To now it is it's 79.7 for men and around 85, 84 for women. So it is, we're increasing it about someplace around a month and a half every year, which is really outrageous. So if I'm 69 now, my life expectancy as a male is actually about 84. But that means that, a woman my age, a 69-year-old woman's life expectancy is 89, which means that half of the women who are 69 will live to be past 89 into their 90th and beyond years. So that's really amazing. Now, the problem we have is that 50% of those women will develop mental dysfunction after age 85. So the key point that we have to do, and that is very possible, is to delay all these things as much as possible. And we can delay them probably on mental dysfunction someplace 20 to 25 years from what we know now, and really radically decrease the population of people who get mental dysfunction before they die of frailty. Well, the hope is that we can keep that ratio up so that you can get to be 160 without any mental dysfunction and without frailty and having the energy you want until you get struck by lightning and die.
Sure. No, that'd be great. I mean, interestingly enough, my goal is to live to 104. Why? Because my grandfather lived to 104 and he was he lived his entire life in Cuba. And I figure if he can live to 104 and without the aid of today's technologies latest science information, then I should be able to do it too.
And even illness care, right?
So I want to talk about that. So
if you live to 100, you're not likely to die after that because we don't have many people who die after 100.
Oh, interesting. So if you made it to 100, you're good to go.
No, actually, I've got to say that more obviously a joke in the future, I can see. But obviously the key point is that the possibility exists because when you look at the advances that are occurring even now, so we know now how to repair a lot of damage, how to get your stem cells to make more of themselves, and the stem cells are key in repairing damage. So when you have a heart attack, for example, if you have enough stem cells, they will rush in, and as the damaged cells gets taken away by your inflammatory cells, you can have new stem cells that repopulate your heart, so your pumping function 3 months later is the same as it was before the heart attack. Well, that's one of the keys in maintaining function, is in fact maintaining it not just for your heart, but for all cells. And the key way is to have those, if you will, your stem cells rush in and repair things.
Yeah, you know what? I think that I'm excited. Personally, I'm excited about all the different things that the potential that stem cell has. I think it definitely holds a lot of keys to anti-aging, for lack of better terms, or prolonging our life. And I also wanted to talk about this because I think stem cell seems to be hold some of the keys to this as well, and that is preventing disease and or curing disease. So let me ask you this: is preventing disease, is that the same thing as curing a disease? I mean, is preventing disease about curing, or is that just about putting off?
There are two components to your question. One, is preventing disease the same as preventing aging? And the answer is no. Aging is mainly frailty. If we stopped all diseases that are acute, like cancer and heart disease, we would only gain about 8 years of life expectancy. It is really preventing frailty that is the key. And so that's part of the question. The second question is, if you prevent colon cancer or breast cancer or heart disease, are you just putting it off? And the answer is no. If you screen for it and you detect it early, that's treating it, and preventing its recurrence is preventing it. Or if you don't prevent its recurrence but just temper it, like many people with heart disease, then you're just delaying it. So very good question. You can get delaying as in heart disease. You can get curing as you cut out a cancer or you treat it so that it doesn't recur. And you can get early, which is part of early detection and screening, or you can get preventing. So I can prevent heart disease by exercise, food and food choices and portion size, managing stress, avoiding toxins. That's avoiding it totally so that something else, such as frailty, gets me.
Gotcha, gotcha. All right, let's talk about this. We only have a few minutes left, and I want to skip down and talk about this. Talk about the ultimate longevity foods. Give us some examples of some of these longevity foods are.
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to give you the ones that let me tell you my favorite foods rather than do that. So my favorite foods are any green leafy vegetables cooked with a little olive oil and some walnuts and maybe rosemary or turmeric for seasoning. So you get olive oil as omega-9, which decreases your risk of heart disease, slows the aging relating to your cardiovascular system. Leafy greens have a lot of essential vitamins, nutrients, and colorful things which also help prevent macular degeneration and cataracts. Walnuts have ALA in them, which prevent, again, the ALA is an omega-3, which helps prevent heart disease and helps prevent joint disease. You have salmon, then, as another dish, and wild salmon, inexpensive in salmon burgers that you can get frozen, or in canned salmon, because that's the overage of the Alaska salmon run. And what that does is it gives you omega-3, the DHA. They don't make it themselves, the salmon. They get it from algae. But, in fact, that omega-3 helps preserve brain, eye, and joint function, as well as immune function. And then it is any of your favorite foods that don't raise your blood sugar and that don't have saturated or trans fat with them. So I can pick out a number of them. It is, if you will, I love mushrooms. I love broccoli. But broccoli and the cruciferous vegetables are a superfood because they also decrease your risk of about 9 cancers. So does coffee, surprisingly. So if you're a slow metabolizer of coffee, you get only side effects, which is 12% of Americans. If you're a fast metabolizer, 88% of us are, you don't get headaches, heart arrhythmias, gastric upset, or anxiety when you have coffee. If you're a fast metabolizer, it's a superfood in decreasing your risk of cancer as well. So those are my favorites, but it is pick your favorite vegetable. I'm going to give you one more since it's a guy's show that you're on, so to speak, and that is watermelon. Watermelon helps blood flow because it produces, or it's the forerunner of the nitric oxide. Nitric oxide is what is prolonged with Viagra, Levitra, and Cialis. And it does that by increasing blood flow. It increases blood flow for both men and women, and not only the genitals, but to all areas. So watermelon has citrulline, which turns to arginine, which becomes the nitric oxide. You have to have the citrulline because we don't absorb and process arginine straight well, so you need the citrulline rather than get it. And the best food for that is watermelon.
So if you can't get a hold of Viagra, eat a watermelon.
Well, in fact, watermelon is actually better because, one, it is virtually free, meaning you're not paying any place near as much, and it's helping the basics of the process. So as we get older, I'm going to do one more thing. As we get older, we have two ways we make nitric oxide. One is it's always there, called constitutive, and one is inducible. Well, as we get older, the reason it takes longer for warm-ups in bed and in exercise and in every other activity is because the constitutive nitric oxide isn't there to any great degree. Well, watermelon increases that, so you have it that always there nitric oxide rather than just prolonging what is there, you get it more of it to begin with.
Gotcha, gotcha. All right, so real quick, you were mentioning something about walnuts, olive oil, and turmeric?
Right, Turmeric decreases inflammation. It's a great spice from India, curcumin, and that is a derivative of it, if you will, and turmeric. They have a lot less, if you will, Alzheimer's disease and inflammation of the brain. Alzheimer's really causes inflammation of the brain, as does many other mental dysfunction diseases. And so turmeric decreases that by activating your waste removal and decreasing inflammation in your brain and elsewhere in your body. So you can put on curcumin or turmeric locally on an injury, and initially you'll have pain, and then it'll go away as you deplete the inflammation in the area. So that's a great thing to use as a spice, because it does have the internal effect as well. And olive oil is an omega-9, which is great for preventing cardiovascular disease. Walnuts is that ALA omega-3, which decreases joint disease as well as cardiovascular disease.
Wow, it's amazing. It's amazing. You know, and what the shame of it is, too, Dr. Roizen, is we are really fighting a battle, because you have all these food manufacturers that are creating, for lack of better terms, a lot of crappy food, these highly processed foods. And part of that is our fault, the consumers, because we don't want to take a whole 20 or 30 minutes to make a really good meal. We want to pop it in the microwave and have a meal in 5 or 7 minutes. And we're paying the price for that. We're seeing Alzheimer's disease explode. We're seeing obesity explode. We're seeing all these diseases explode. And then, but as consumers, most of us don't want to take responsibility on our part. We have, to some extent, a control over how we prepare and eat our foods.
We have a huge amount of control over how we eat and prepare our food. So you're exactly right. And a lot of it is we don't want to shop as well as don't want to cook. And so there are a couple of services now that will send you healthy food in the right amounts, that all you have to do is then put it in the pan and cook it. And so whether it's plate.com, and there's another one I saw advertised on TV this weekend, so you can send them recipes and they will pick it and send it to you. So it's in the right amounts, it's fresh, it's insulated, and you can do it whether you've got a family of one or a family of 14. They'll send you a week's worth of recipes, whatever you want to send them, and they'll do that. And so you really can take it. But you're right, and it's, let me tell you how important it is. So you quoted Alzheimer's, but let's look at type 2 diabetes. When I started practicing, 2 million type 2 diabetics, 1974. Last year, 2014, 30 million, 29 million. In 2050 in America, although we're only increasing our population 30%, that number goes up 5 to 6-fold, between 120 and 180 million. That will use over 10% of our GDP, not 10% of our medical expenses, which it already does. It'll use 10% of our GDP, and there are 6 other diseases like that. So we won't have to have anything else in life, because we'll be spending it all on this, which obviously means we have to have either rationing or we have to get rational. We can prevent 80 to 90, we already know how to prevent 80 to 90% of chronic diseases. It's in the book, and it's no secret. So we know how to prevent that, and if we don't, we're going to have more social inequality, more social disrest. We'll have no money to spend on social programs or education, and no money to spend on research for new jobs. So we will be in big trouble. The good news is that we've exported all of our bad habits, so the rest of the world won't be more competitive than we are. The bad news is we'll all be spending and dealing with this rationing versus getting rational issue. But the great news is if we take charge now, if you do some of the things in you staying young, you can reduce your risk of chronic disease by 80 to 90% and literally save society.
I love it. I love it. Okay, the book, again, it's the number one New York Times best-selling book, You Staying Young. It is by Dr. Michael Roizen and Dr. Emmett Oz. You can find it anywhere, Amazon or any bookstore. Again, it's You Staying Young, Dr. Michael Roizen. Thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Thank you very much.
All right, guys, that's a wrap. Good stuff there about you and your health, your mental, faculties, everything that you're concerned about your health can be solved by eating some of these good foods. Pick up the book, You Staying Young is the name of the book. Pick it up, study it, master it, live a long and happy life. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.